Headlines: North Korea warns of what it calls unprecedentedly strong responses if Seoul and Washington move ahead with their planned military drills next week. The United Nations says it will slash food aid to the Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh, blaming a funding shortfall for the decision. Also ahead, nurses in England say they will stage yet another strike amid a bitter dispute with the government over pay. Welcome. Our top story: North Korea warns of what it calls unprecedentedly strong responses if Seoul and Washington move ahead with their planned military drills next week. The North Korean Foreign Ministry slammed the upcoming exercises, saying they will only cause tensions to rise in the region. It also said Pyongyang would consider additional military action if the UN Security Council does not stop pressuring North Korea under the influence of Washington. The United States and South Korea say they will hold tabletop drills at the Pentagon on February 22 in order to improve operations of American nuclear assets and strengthen deterrence. The two countries described their exercises as defensive, citing the growing number of North Korea's missile tests. Pyongyang, however, says the drills are, in fact, invasion rehearsals. We asked our correspondent in Seoul, Jennifer Chang, to give us more detail about the upcoming joint military drill between Seoul and Washington and how that could affect the tense situation in the Korean Peninsula.
They're going to hold these tabletop exercises next Wednesday at the Pentagon in Washington, D.C. They're sending high-level defense ministry officials from South Korea to those exercises, which are going to practice nuclear war with North Korea. They're going to discuss how they're going to have a nuclear war with North Korea, if necessary. And after that, those South Korean defense officials will be taken to a U.S. naval base in Georgia the next day, on Thursday of next week, to see nuclear submarines of the U.S., which, of course, play a key role in any possible nuclear war with North Korea. So now this means that they are increasing pressure on North Korea. And, of course, North Korea is expected to conduct its seventh nuclear test not too far from now. And that will be a big game changer because it, of course, refrained from conducting nuclear tests while the North Korean leader and former U.S. President Trump were trying to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula by holding talks. Those talks fell apart. And the North has said it will never hold such talks again with the U.S.
Devastation, destruction, and desperation. That's the picture in quake-hit regions in Turkey and Syria. The miraculous survival under the rubble of collapsed buildings, however, can't relieve people's pain and grief. A teenage boy and two men were rescued in the Turkish province of Hatay after being trapped under debris for 260 hours. However, hopes of finding more survivors are diminishing, as 11 days have passed after the 7.8 magnitude earthquake jolted parts of Turkey and Syria. Freezing weather also frustrates rescue efforts. So far, the combined death toll from the natural disaster has topped 42,000. Thousands of more have either been injured or displaced in the two neighboring countries. Rashan Saglam is our correspondent in the Turkish city of Istanbul, and also Muhammad Ali is our reporter on the ground in Damascus, the Syrian capital. What's the latest there on the ground in Turkey, the affected parts in the south?
I will say that yesterday we witnessed another earthquake, and this was not an aftermath to the earthquake that took place 11 days ago, and you just mentioned it was 7.8 magnitude. It was another earthquake in another point near the coastal area of Hatay. And it was a 5.1 earthquake. It was mainly felt in Hatay, also in Syria and in Lebanon. So at the coast, this coastal area at the Mediterranean, it was felt strongly. And a building actually in Aleppo fell due to this latest earthquake. So another earthquake, not an aftermath. And getting back to the numbers that we usually update you with, there are so far, the number of casualties are more than 40,000 in Turkey. The injured are more than 110,000. The buildings that have so far collapsed due to the earthquakes, the first and second one that took place on 11 days ago, on the 6th of February, were 50,000 buildings. Also, 2.2 million people have been displaced due to those earthquakes. And the earthquakes have affected more than 13 million people in the 10 cities, 7 provinces in southern Turkey. Now, people are still coming out from under the debris alive. Just between yesterday and today, 7 people were rescued from under the debris, especially in Hatay and Kahramanmaraş. The search and rescue operations are still continuing, and the government says they will not stop until they no longer hear the sound of people calling for rescue from under the debris. So the search and rescue will still continue. Now, let me just mention that starting from the beginning of March, the government said that they will start rebuilding 30,000 buildings out of the 50,000 that collapsed due to the earthquake. So this is a good news for people who are displaced. We are in dire need here in Turkey for shelter for those people. Some of them are sitting now in tents for the 11th day, and it is freezing cold, as you mentioned. It is sometimes it is below 20 degrees, minus 20 degrees in Adıyaman, at Malatya, for example. And in other areas, it does not exceed 5 degrees Celsius. So it is really cold in those areas. Now, also, the government has said that they are trying to give aid. However, one of the biggest aid that was offered was after 7 hours of Turkish actors, singers, and media journalists have gathered more than $6 billion in nationwide TV broadcasting that took place all over the TV channels in Turkey and lasted for 7 hours. They were able to raise $6 billion or more than $6 billion from people, from investors, from economists in Turkey, from regular people, and from businessmen in Turkey. So this number will definitely be a big help for the rebuilding those 10 cities. Now, of course, the aftermath are still continuing, and the government is calling people who do not have any permission to go back to their places, not to go back, because there is still continuous work to do to make sure that the buildings that did not collapse in the 10 cities are still strong and can still people can still go back to those buildings. The Interior Minister said that after 1 week we will be able to assess which buildings we will keep or which buildings we will have to take down as of next week, of course, so that people can either go back to their places or they can be displaced to other places in across Turkey. A lot of people have moved to Istanbul, actually, from either Turkish people or Syrian displaced people, knowing that those 10 cities have a lot of Syrian displaced people who fled from Syria to Turkey. Those are, again, displaced to other cities in Turkey, in Istanbul, Konya, and Ankara mainly.
Okay, Mohammed, the Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad, he expressed his gratitude for the nations that have provided regional nations, governments that have provided assistance, but how desperate are the Syrian people for more assistance? We saw the images that went viral on social media of mobile cell phone airplane tracking applications that showed how many airplanes were heading to Turkey and how empty the skies of Syria were.
Unfortunately, this is the situation over here. People are desperate. It's a tragic situation, unlike any other throughout history, due to the war that Syria witnessed in the past 11 or 12 years. Now, following this war, we witnessed this powerful earthquake that left, according to the UN, more than 5 million people in desperate need, whether for food, medicine, basic needs, or most importantly, shelter. Let me start by the recent developments. According to the National Syrian Center for Earthquakes, just last night, there was this powerful 5.4 magnitude aftershock that hit areas like Aleppo and Latakia. Mainly also residents of Damascus felt it, which left people on the streets during the night, fearing any possible collapses as a result of this powerful earthquake. Of course, already there are large numbers of people now displaced because of the collapses, because of fear of any future collapses. They need help, they need shelter. This is the most important issue and the biggest challenge for the Syrian government, perhaps, and the UN to find shelter, temporary shelter centers for this large number of people who are now displaced. There are hundreds of tragic stories now for people either who lost their homes, lost everything they have. There are some individuals who lost entire family members. So you can imagine how devastating the situation is. Going back to numbers, according to the Syrian Red Crescent, so far more than 224,000 aid items, whether food, medicine, or water, have been distributed to more than 172,000 people in affected areas, mainly Aleppo, Hama, and Latakia. Also, the aid coming from some countries continue to arrive in various parts of Syria, in various airports, Damascus and Latakia and Aleppo. Just this morning, according to the Syrian Arab Red Crescent, a ship loaded with aid coming from Italy and the EU arrived in Beirut, and this aid will be handed over to the Syrian Red Crescent by the Lebanese Red Cross. This is the second kind of shipment from a European country, from Italy. The last was on the 11th of this month. Also, four airplanes from the UAE arrived this morning carrying aid to Latakia and Damascus. So despite the fact that there are some countries providing support and aid, but much more is needed. And most importantly, lifting the sanctions on Syria, the U.S. and Western sanctions. Just yesterday, I was attending a press conference for about 550 NGOs. The person, the representative who was reading out the statement, was crying, saying that because of those sanctions, throughout all of those years, Syria was not able to import the equipment needed today for rescuing people. Many died because of those sanctions as a result. So devastating situation, and more help is definitely needed.
Rashan Saglam, thank you very much indeed. Rashan is our correspondent in the Turkish city of Istanbul. Mohammed, thank you. Mohammed Ali is our correspondent in the Syrian capital, Damascus. Let's move on now. Concerns are growing over the grim situation of the Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh after the United Nations announced its plan to cut food aid to the persecuted Muslim group. The World Food Programme said it will reduce the monthly allowance allocated to every Rohingya refugee to $10. The WFP said the plan will come into effect as of March, blaming a lack of funding for the cuts. Following the announcement, international NGO Save the Children warned the move would take a heavy toll on Rohingya children who are already grappling with malnutrition in refugee camps in Bangladesh. Two UN special rapporteurs also warned of devastating consequences, especially during the holy month of Ramadan. Around 730,000 Rohingya fled to Bangladesh in 2017 amid a brutal military crackdown in their native Myanmar. Nurses in England are to stage yet another strike amid a bitter dispute with the government over what they call its refusal to negotiate over pay. The Royal College of Nursing, a union representing nurses in Britain, said the strike will run continuously for 48 hours starting from March the 1st. The industrial action will affect more than 120 state-run health facilities. In another sign of escalation, nursing staff working in emergency departments, intensive care units and cancer care will also join the move for the first time. The strikers demand a pay rise to cope with a high inflation level. It will be the latest in a series of walkouts that have hit various sectors over the past year, causing widespread disruption in the country, which is grappling with a cost of living crisis. And with that, we end our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
What about you? IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution during a meeting with a number of eulogists and religious poets in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniya on January 12, 2023. The meeting took place one day before the anniversary of the birth of Lady Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alayha. I saw that, for example, if we place 10 lines of Imam Hussein's supplication for the day of Arafah, or supplication 47 of Sahifat al-Sajjadiyah next to those supplications, we will see these 10 lines have more content and greater spirit than all those supplications have together. Well, these emotional states have also aided the country in sensitive times. One being during the Holy Defense. During the Holy Defense, it was the elegists, the poets, these good poets who were truly able to prepare the atmosphere for the great epic event. I have read this verse of a poem many times in this regard. We warm the lovers with the sharpness of our words. We strike the butterfly like the flame of a candle does. This describes your situation. We strike the butterfly like the flame of a candle does. Elegies played a great role in preparing the hearts and increasing the spirituality of the environment. When sending the members of the Basij and others to the front lines, on the nights of military operations, during the military drills, at dawn, during the burial and funeral processions of the martyrs and the mosques and in Husayniyas on the battlefield and everywhere else.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The holiness that was prevalent in the regions where the holy defense was going on was unprecedented and has never occurred anywhere in the world at any time in history, apart from the early days of Islam. A major part of it was related to the elegies, and another part of it was related to other factors. It has been the same in the years after the war and up until today. Elegies have played a great role in various situations. During the sedition in 1388, that is, 2009, on the 9th of day of that year, and on various other occasions. I'm repeating these things for you so that as elegist, you can understand your position, what you're doing and what you're capable of doing. This is my intention, thank God. There are many of you as well. When we used to have these meetings in the beginning, only about 100 or 200 people would attend. Today, there are thousands of people across the country who are engaged in the work of reciting elegies and are mastering various techniques for attracting their audiences. This is a great phenomenon that is taking place in the country, and we need to take advantage of it.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witch hunt.
Turn here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
Every night, more than 300,000 men, women, and children in the United States stay in homeless shelters. An additional 200,000 or so spend each night unsheltered, whether on the street or in other locations such as subway trains, vehicles, etc. Families with children represent 30% of the U.S. homeless population. More facts, rather gloomy facts, just tell us part of the story. The truth is that homelessness in America can't be explained in facts and figures. The toll that homelessness takes on individuals, families, communities, and society touches every aspect of Americans' lives.
Rent prices have continued to surge, and all while many do not have a fair living wage.
I'm scared I'm gonna wake up or not wake up one morning. One minute they're here and before my eyes drop, like literally, I've had somebody that I knew die right in front of me.
rough sleepers. The statistics on the number of homeless youth in the U.S. fail to tell the whole story because so many young people don't fit the strict definition of homeless. For example, the Department of Housing and Urban Development defines homeless people as those who are living in shelters, in transitional housing, or outdoors. This definition fails to account for the many children and young adults who go from place to place, couch surfing with friends and relatives or paying for short stays at motels. In general, it is reported that almost 600,000 people are homeless in the United States. That's a staggering number for the world's largest economy. So the question is, what are the main roots of this problem?
The problem of homelessness in America has taken off over the last 20 years and become extreme in the last 10. I think the main cause is the domination of the American economy by multinational investment banks, which have bought up real estate in order to make fortunes and then stage these periodic every 8 to 10 year economic crises, which have forced people out of their houses or out of their apartments. And then once the houses are vacated, these investment banks then sell them back to people at a higher price when the economy comes back following their plan.
America's homelessness problem has the makings of an acute crisis. The origins of the current homelessness crisis go back decades, in fact, to policies that stopped the U.S. from building enough housing. According to the National Low-Income Housing Coalition, 7 million extremely low-income renters cannot get affordable homes.
Government has really collapsed. I mean, government had problems in the United States from a long time back, but there used to be things like rent control, controls on real estate that were meant to keep housing affordable.
There are many factors driving the menace of homelessness in America. Poverty, mental illness, addiction, and other issues do play their roles. But what is the main driving force behind the menace of homelessness in today's America?
It's a big question with a few aspects. Definitely need to take a look at like investment firms such as BlackRock buying up single family homes all over the country. And it's not just BlackRock. I mean, but this makes it permanently expensive, artificially driving up the prices of homes for regular people. These billion-dollar corporations have much deeper pockets and can afford much higher prices than your average family, young couple just starting out. Another investment firm is Blackstone, and they bought like 17,000 family homes, single family dwellings, just last year. The fact is these billion-dollar corporations are doing everything they can to squeeze every penny out of the housing market.
Homelessness has become a particularly bad political problem for the Democrats who govern big cities where it is most visible. The new Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass has declared a state of emergency over the homelessness crisis in the city. She says, "We must have a single strategy bringing together government, the private sector, and other stakeholders." Many doubt that her approach could be successful.
Anytime someone talks about a partnership between government and the private sector, I think we're looking at a scam. Government should be opposed to or in partnership with citizens and communities. The private sector is not citizens and it's not the community, although it sounds like it might be. What it means is it means multinational corporations and banks. And these organizations, corporations, are essentially government, except unlike government, they're not transparent or accessible and they're run for short-term profit. So what she's really talking about there is that The way to solve homelessness is to get corporations involved. But corporations have made a fortune by making people homeless. So it's not, in any sense, a solution.
In many big cities, homelessness has become criminalized. This is because big corporations in the housing market know that having homeless people wandering about a neighborhood is not good for the business.
The only possible solution to homelessness would be to get corporations and investment banks out of real estate, out of land, out of housing, and have housing for the people. And the government to be a contract between people who are specialized administrators and the citizens, the local communities.
Business improvement districts, groups of commercial property owners who pool their resources to revitalize their neighborhoods, have worked with some city councils to make hostile architecture. This includes putting spikes on grates or sheltered sidewalks or having slanted benches or closely placed armrests that prevent lying down. In a nutshell, they just want to make life harder for homeless in the big cities.
It's one thing for like a family to buy a home and then, you know, fix it up and sell it while the market happens to be up. It's another thing altogether for billion-dollar corporations to engage in predatory lending that imposes costs on the rest of society, and the only beneficiary is them. That's predatory, that's parasitic, and unfortunately, it's what the entire U.S. elite has become, and the elite in many other Western, and every other Western country, as far as I'm concerned, a predatory class that provides no value to the rest of society.
Racial minorities experience homelessness at a disproportionate rate. For example, African Americans make up 13% of the general population, but 40% of the homeless population. Young Black people have also an 83% higher risk of becoming homeless than their white counterparts.
The reason why African Americans ended up in that particular situation is that they've been used as a sort of political football, that there's an effort by the far right and the corporations that back them in the politics to try and find some sort of an enemy that could be blamed for what is wrong in America, why wealth is concentrated, why it's so hard to get a job, why all of us are so poor. And they've come up basically with two fake enemies, which is African Americans, who are somehow a threat, and therefore, although working class whites are basically in the same position as African-American working class people, somehow the African-Americans are threatening to kill them or whatever, and therefore they should be locked up or they should be deprived from jobs. And this is an old strategy.
Now, of course, the U.S. media do cover stories and reports of homelessness, but the story has not become mainstream. Is it not that big a problem?
In general, the U.S. media has just become a PR firm for the deep state. I mean, I remember when I was 19 and they were enthusiastically selling the war on terror to not just the American population, but to that of all its allies. And it was disgusting at that time. And it's only gotten worse. It's only gotten more corrupt, more partisan. And at this point, they've dropped any pretense of objectivity or journalistic integrity. The job of the American media isn't to focus on issues that matter, it's to indoctrinate the masses. It's a propaganda tool used to distract gullible partisans of both parties, but particularly the Democrats.
The criminalization of homelessness is increasing as local governments find legal loopholes and replicate discriminatory policies, practices, and proposals from one place to the next. The corporate media sometimes exaggerate the problems caused by the homeless people and helps create more and more hostile architecture.
And to make them believe that pointless issues like January 6th, an event where some misguided folks took an impromptu tour of the U.S. Capitol building, that that's the real issue instead of, you know, things that are happening that affect actual people. The American media will tell you that the most press, that that's the most, these shallow partisan issues or are the most pressing issues today, or they'll hyperventilate because some country like like Russia or Qatar doesn't show proper reverence for homosexuality.
Another social menace facing the country is suicide. Official data show that both the number and the rate of suicides in the United States increased 4% from 2020 to 2021 after two consecutive years of decline. It is a sign, experts say, that suicide rates are inching back up to levels seen before the pandemic. Now, of course, factors like poverty and homelessness can have a role in the increase of the suicides. But what are the other factors?
I don't think that the increase in suicide and the abuse of drugs and medication is related to poverty per se or to homelessness, although obviously these affect it. It is a rather a consequence of a lack of hope and a sense of despair about American society. That people feel, especially young people, but across the board, that there's nothing you can do, that the whole system is so rigged up that there is no escape.
Despite the stresses associated with the pandemic, suicide rates did not increase in 2020. But a report by the Washington Post says suicides have been increasing steadily since 1999, going up 35% over two decades. 35% is simply too high. What should be done to tackle this social menace?
Well, it's really hard because, I mean, I'm not sure that there's anything that can be done. Like, to be honest, I mean, obviously there are policies that could be implemented. But the problem is this is part, as I said previously, in my opinion, this is part of a historical process that I'm afraid will be forced to be played out because the changes that would be required would be so fundamental that it would require a complete restructuring, not only of Western economies, but how the West sees itself and sees the world. I think America, for America, it needs to realize that it was a proposition nation, and proper nations aren't proposition nations. I mean, that's not what, like, fills people's lives with joy. I mean, that's not what human beings yearn for in our hearts. I mean, at the end of the day, being a little bit richer or a little bit poorer, that's not what matters to in the human experience. Real nations are built on an appreciation for history, on a foundation of faith built with strong families who all share a common history and an ethnos and a way of being in the world and a rootedness that just doesn't exist in American society.
So it can be concluded that the 2021 increases may reflect in part a return to normalcy. A new report has found out that males aged 15 to 24 continue to be at higher risk than other groups committing suicides.
In the case of suicide, I would suggest, or for that matter, poverty, that the basic challenge is getting the economy and local society back in the hands of citizens, that people should own their own homes locally, that banks should be cooperatives run by local citizens, that we should grow our own food, have our own farms, have our own markets, and not have these multinational investment banks and corporations preying upon ordinary people.
Measuring suicide rates is uniquely challenging for a variety of reasons. For example, to know that a death was due to suicide requires some certainty about intent, which is often not easy to confirm. Researchers emphasize that the reported rates are likely an undercount of the true suicide toll for all the groups.
That the contemporary West is facing is community life has completely eroded. I mean, over the last 300 years, Western civilization has completely rejected religion and proceeded to destroy institutions and social institutions and traditions. I mean, we've exalted money above all else and embraced cultural nihilism. If you look around, Western countries have become completely narcissistic. And this is a very, very deep problem, and it's not one that started yesterday. In my opinion, it's part of a historical process and is actually the fruits of American ideology and American liberalism.
The suicide morality is the second and third leading cause of death for Black and Hispanic populations, respectively, compared to the ninth leading cause of death for whites. While research gaps remain, current data also indicates that suicide morality affects incarcerated people at far higher rates than the national average, and the toll is also growing among military members. The political debate in the United States seems to be in state of partisan deadlock. How much does this political rivalry push up the social crises mentioned earlier?
The Republican Party would appeal to those who want to be independent of government, which is a good thing if you have a corrupt, predatory government. But the Republicans offer as an alternative, not organizing the community, but rather appealing or using multinational corporations, privatization of government functions, not empowering citizens. In the case of the Democrats, they're basically playing the same game, but what they use is cultural identity games.
I don't think American or any other political elites are going to accomplish anything. I think we're just going to see more and more deadlock. And the fact is American elites don't care about their people. They just don't. And so what we're seeing right now is an empire in decline. And I think mostly, other than a few renegade politicians, we're looking at politicians who are in the raid, the treasury stage of imperial decline. So the idea that the politicians are like going to solve these issues, it is fantasy.
The pursuit of happiness is the most famous phrase in the Declaration of Independence. It is attributed to Founding Father Thomas Jefferson, who borrowed it from political philosopher John Locke. Jefferson edited out Locke's right to property and replaced it with the pursuit of happiness. But if you look at the number of homeless and suicides in America, you understand that phrase, whatever the version, has been a false promise to many Americans.
Peace, and welcome back to Power to the People. On today's segment, we are going to take a look at homelessness, or as we call it here, houselessness in the United States. Despite America being a so-called first world country, as well as one of the most technologically advanced nations in the world, there are nearly 600,000 people who live on the streets, and the vast amount of people living in the streets are Black. It's estimated that 40% of people nationwide who are homeless are Black, despite Black people making up 13% of America's population. And it's also estimated that 50% of homeless families in the United States are Black as well. We as Black people, we were literally enslaved in this country and forced to build it up, yet we make up nearly half of the country's homeless population. And one of the major forces that has put Black people onto the streets is gentrification. Gentrification is the systematic removal of Black people from Black neighborhoods, and it makes way for these new white settlers to move in. These white settlers, they move into black neighborhoods, they buy up the property, they redevelop it, which increases the value of properties, and then it makes these neighborhoods largely unaffordable. The government, they also use policies like eminent domain to take black people's properties and kick them out. If this ain't settler colonialism, I don't know what is. This has led to cities like Oakland, California, that were once almost 50% black, to having the black population decrease to just a bit over 20%. And while many will blame homelessness solely on drugs and mental health issues, the root of the problem is white supremacist settler colonialism that uses the inhumane economic system of capitalism all for the settlers' gain. This racist capitalist system, it produces a society where 600,000 people are living on the streets, yet there's over 16 million housing units in the US that are empty. Yet these politicians, they will say they need to build more housing. And this exposes the parasitic nature of capitalism. Capitalism creates homelessness to create a fake demand for housing. And this allows corporations to build more housing that isn't even built for houseless people. This allows these corporations to make billions upon billions of dollars off of fake demand for more housing. And these same companies, they also control the market and will crash the market on purpose and then buy it all up. For example, in 2021, investors bought a quarter of the homes sold and used their control of the market to drive up rents. This skyrocketing rate of rent, all during a deadly pandemic, led to more people being on the streets. If we look at the state of California, a so-called liberal and progressive state that has a multi-billion dollar surplus in its reserves, 29% of homes bought were by corporations in 2021. This led to California's homeless population growing by over 22,000 people, and all of this was in the middle of a pandemic. In California, it refuses to house its houseless population, and instead, it keeps properties vacant. This shows that it's truly a political and economic decision to keep people on the street. But this is America for what it is. It values profit over human life. And thousands upon thousands of houseless people die in the streets every single year. And it's estimated that 20 houseless people die every single day in the streets of America. So we must fight this inhumane system. We must fight to build an egalitarian society with communal ways of living. Because in no world should a nation be able to have millions of abandoned housing, yet hundreds of thousands of people are sleeping on the streets every single night. This is violence. This is power to the people.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
The Last Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us a sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah. To the Redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome. You're listening to The Last Savior. This is your host, Zainab. I am with Dr. Karimi. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, dear listeners, as we know, to know about Imam of our time, it's really important to know about the Imam himself, and it's also important to know about his friends and foes. And some of his friends and foes have been discussed in the signs. Yes, we had been talking about the signs of reappearance, and right now we had been talking about a person named Sufyani who will rise before the reappearance of Imam. Because there are many false claimants who say that I am Sufyani. So how we can actually recognize, is it the real certain sign of reappearance? Is it the real Sufyani who has been talked about a lot in the narrations? In this episode, we will talk about the place of his uprising. Yes, Dr. Karimi, in our previous session, we concluded our session with the narration which said about we concluded our session with some of the sayings which say that where Sufyani is going to rise. But you said there are a couple of narrations that lead us to one conclusion. I would want you to continue.
Sure. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As I mentioned in the previous session, when it comes to the place of the uprising of Sufyani, there are three groups of the narrations, and maybe at the first glance they may contradict each other, but we will come to a conclusion which, according to which there is no contradiction between all these narrations. As you rightly mentioned, we are talking about the signs of the reappearance of Imam Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, and of course the definite ones. And maybe one of the most important ones in terms of the signs is that of the uprising of Sufyani. Because of the fact that, because of the number of the narrations that are quoted from the Imam of the Ahlul Bayt about this person himself, about all the details of his uprising, and also about the number of the countries which will be involved after his uprising. And of course, the other issue that I think we talked about is the fact that, he will try, his main goal is just to kill the Shia.
All right.
So that is why, as Shia, it is very important for us to know about different details of the uprising of Sufyani and himself. We talked about some of the details about him. According to some narrations, and of course, when we are talking about the place of his uprising, we are talking about the place where he begins his uprising.
Okay.
Because he will go to many places, many countries, like Iraq, even Medina in Saudi Arabia, and so on and so forth. Now, according to the first group of the narrations, his uprising begins from what we call it Sham. Let me share a couple of narrations.
And
in
you
this
said
regard.
This Sham is not what we call Assyria.
Exactly. I share this narration and then I will explain about the word Sham.
Yeah.
There is a narration, for example, in Kamaluddin, page 328, chapter 32, hadith number 7. And in another narration, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, Yakhruju bis-Sham. Sufyani will begin his uprising from Sham. Fayanqadu lahu ahlu Sham. And the people of Sham will obey him, will act upon his orders.
Okay.
This is in Al-Ghiba by Nu'mani, chapter 18, page 316, hadith number 14. Now, having said that and answering your question, it is very important to know about the word Sham, because it is mentioned in many narrations, and not in all the cases it is referring to today's Damascus or Syria. When it comes to the word Sham, as it's mentioned in the narrations of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim wassalam, we are talking about the old Syria or the old Sham, or what we call it Levant. And according to the books of geography written in the past, like Mu'jam al-Buldan, volume 1, page 103, that place, that region known as Sham in the past, includes five regions. Damascus, the city of Damascus, that nowadays it is in Syria, Homs, Qennasrin, these three cities, and then Palestine and Jordan. So right. This is very important. So right. Today,
so it's
Syria.
Not, it's not particularly Syria.
Exactly.
It could be many other things.
Exactly.
I'll ask you more on that after a short break.
Sure.
Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
This is the last Savior which comes to you.
Who is the Mahdi?
Longevity.
His training for the mission.
Reasons for his continued existence.
Reasons for delay in his appearance.
Al-Mahdi, in light of Hadith.
Al-Mahdi, in light of Quranic verses.
Women in the Imam's army.
The completion of knowledge.
The last Savior.
The question comes in my mind. What next?
What next? What next? The final victory.
There are references to a person who will come as the savior of mankind.
I know he's one of the Ahl Bayt and the last one, and he's going to change the world.
Welcome back. You're listening to Last Savior. This is IRIB English Radio. I'm with Dr. Karimi, and Dr. Karimi is helping us to know about Sufyani, who is one of the certain signs of reappearance. We're talking about the place of his uprising.
Yeah, as I mentioned, according to the first group of the narrations, he will begin his uprising from Sham. But Sham in such narrations is referring to the old understanding and sense of the world. And according to the books of geography, it's not limited to Syria, but it also includes Palestine and Jordan, or at least some parts of these two countries.
So as we have a modern world, we have more borders. But when we go back to time,
exactly.
We do not have enough borders, so it could not mean exactly Syria.
Definitely. So because nowadays some people read the narrations about Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, and they read about all these signs, they come across the word Sham, and they just understand it to be today Syria. But this is not the case. It might be, but it's not limited to Syria. It includes at least two other countries, Palestine and Jordan. So this is a very important point regarding the term Sham as mentioned in the narrations. So this is the first group of the narrations according to which Sufyani comes from Sham. And as I mentioned, it includes five regions at least. The second group of the narrations talk about a region called Al-Wadi Al-Yabis. Literally, it means a dried land. There are some narrations in this regard in Kamaluddin, page 651, chapter 57, hadith number 9, and Al-Ghiba by Nu'mani, page 317, hadith number 16. Let me just share one narration in this regard from Imam As-Sajjad alayhi salam, who says, ثُمَّ يَخْرُجُ السُّفْيَانِ الْمَلْعُونَ مِنَ الْوَادِ الْيَابِسِ. So the Imam is talking about different events before the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, and one of them is the uprising of Sufyani, and Imam calls him Al-Mal'un, the accursed one, and he will come from Al-Wadi Al-Yabis, the dried land. This is in Al-Ghiba by Sheikh Tusi, page 444, hadith number 437. And the third group of the narration refer to the fact that Sufyani will come from Al-Maghrib, from the West.
Okay.
And I will explain what do we mean by this word.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds.